Yo, it's me. And I have laryngitis, and I'm just telling you that right out the gate because I like keeping it real with you, unlike some other podcast hosts who just, you know, they come on the show with laryngitis and they just act like they don't. I'm not going to name names, Ira Glass, but, you know, they come on the show sounding like the squeaky wheel on a grocery cart, and it's like, yo, Ira, what are you doing? And I mean, it's all good, but just, like, let me know about it beforehand, you know? So I'm just letting you know that I got laryngitis, and I'm just going to try to keep my voice in this low, sexy tonal range to make it a little less noticeable. Hopefully this low range doesn't make my voice completely drop out of the mix with the noise gate that Chrissy Bear over at Marmalade Music usually puts on the episodes to drown out the background noise. If you're new to the show and you don't know what I'm talking about, Chrissy Bear is the audio engineer who mixes and masters this show, and Marmalade Music is his business, and his services are available to you, the listener. You can go to marmalademusicslc.com, tell them that you listen to this show, and you can get 20% off your first project, so that's a screaming deal. Go do that. Also, if you're new to this show, one thing we've been doing lately is you can go to Apple Podcasts and rate this podcast 5 stars and leave a review. And I'll read that review on the show, and I'll review you back, and I'll even throw in a plug for anything you're trying to plug. Last week, I plugged the new Godsmack album and tour dates. So, you know, anything you want to plug, let me know. Also, let me know who you are in the review so that I can do an adequate review of you back. It works like this. This week, I'm reading a review from Alice Ryan. She rates the show 5 stars, of course, because you gotta if you want to get it read on the show. Also, because, come on, the show's a 5-star show. Alice says, new favorite podcast. People Pleaser is a wonderful collection of conversations about a myriad of topics from a myriad of people and perspectives. Each episode, I feel like I am part of the conversation and in the blanket fort with Austin and the guests. My favorite way to spend my commute. Now, that is a lovely review. Thank you so much, Alice. And if you didn't know, I mean, you should, but podcasts are great for commutes. So if you're thinking, like, I just don't have time for podcasts, put it on while you're commuting, you know, while you're driving to and from work. Alice is a singer with the voice of an angel. An actor with the instincts of a young Meryl Streep, and a wonderfully expressive dancer, hustling and bustling out in the city that never sleeps, New York. She's out there amidst 50,000 equity actors who are competing for about 2,000 jobs, maybe less. And I mean, it's just so admirable. I admire anyone who has the, I don't want to say balls because that's too masculine a term, and I don't want to rob Alice of her feminine power. So it takes a lot of, I don't know if I can say this, but I feel like if I say it and I let everyone know that I'm saying this in the most feminist way possible, like maybe we can get this trending, you know? It takes a lot of labia to do something like that. It takes a majora amount of labia to go out and compete in a hard city like that. Let's get that trending, all right? You know, that person's got a majora amount of labia, I'll tell you what. And then we can use the balls thing for bad stuff. Like, it's still like, what do you get the balls to talk to me like that? That's still for the bad stuff. Like, you got the balls to say that to me, but then if it's something that's like really gutsy, like, wow, that takes a lot of labia. Geez, I wonder how many listeners I just lost for saying that. Alice is amazing, seriously, and I can't wait to see what's up next for her. I really think that she's gonna slay dragons out there, and yeah, she's the bomb. And that's how it works. 5 stars, leave a review. 5 stars, sorry. Leave a review, and I'll read it, and I'll review you back. Okay, here is the show. You know the saying, you've got to learn to roll with the punches? It's obvious, but if you didn't know, or if you've just never really thought about it, rolling with the punches is an actual tactic specific to the sport of boxing. The tactic being referred to, of course, is a defensive technique employed when a fighter recognizes that a jab or hook is coming in too fast for them to duck out of the way, and the only thing they can do to protect themselves is roll with the momentum of the punch. It'll probably still hurt, but maybe slightly less than it would if they were to just stand there and take it. Football players understand this idea too, particularly quarterbacks. Sometimes you see that middle linebacker break through and you can tell by how fast he's moving and the look in his eye that in about 0.3 seconds he's going to hit you as hard as he possibly can. And you know you won't be able to get out of the way, so it's best to just fall to the ground with him. There will be bruises, both physical and mental. A little pain is almost unavoidable. But perhaps by rolling with the hit rather than leaning into it, you can prevent a blown-out knee or a TKO. It's a great piece of advice for dealing with the jabs and hooks and middle linebacker blitzes life throws at us at a near-constant rate. At least the ones we see coming. After all, rolling with the punches only works if you're able to first recognize that a punch has been thrown. It's the ones we don't see that often do the most damage. The ones we have zero time to prepare for. We're going about our daily routine, replying to emails, scrolling the internet. Maybe we're planning a big event, laying out our very best strategies and envisioning the perfect way it will all unfold. In this case, we are the quarterback who just noticed that his wide receiver on the long route is loose near the end zone. We can see the touchdown celebration unfolding in our minds before the ball even leaves our hands. We can hear the crowd building in ecstatic anticipation. We quickly calculate the strength needed to heave the ball the necessary distance for success. We pull back, eyes on the prize, preparing for victory, and bam! The corner blitz we never saw coming sends a shocking burst of white light through our entire central nervous system. The ball flies awkwardly out of our grasp and we are smacked viciously to the turf. Our brains can barely compute what is even happening. We regain our senses just enough to see the opposing team scoop the ball off the ground and run the other direction for a touchdown that just moments ago was meant to be our own. The momentum has been suddenly and irreversibly changed. Two things are constant in life. Death and taxes, right? Well, I'll add a third. Death, taxes, and change. My sister-in-law Lisa has a story loaded with plenty of all three. I wanted her for this topic because I find her story relatable and human, but also because I find her resilience and power in the face of adversity to be incredibly admirable and inspiring. I'm really excited for you to hear what she's got to say. She'd never say this about herself, so I'll say it for her. She's the kind of person who takes a brutal sucker punch from life. I'm talking a real lights-out haymaker. Then slowly rises off the mat, eyes swollen, head spinning, mouth full of blood, before confidently and decisively raising her fists and getting back to work. And that's really all any of us are striving to do, right? We're trying to learn how to roll with the punches we see coming and how to keep fighting through the ones we don't. And this doesn't just apply for the monumental, dizzying, gut-wrenching changes. It also applies to the little day-to-day shifts. Maybe it's just the change in your mood when someone cuts you off on the freeway or when you have a less than optimal interaction with a coworker. Maybe you're the host of a podcast and your voice suddenly sounds like Chuck Norris roundhouse kicked you in the windpipe. It could be any number of ways that life finds to crumple up your best laid plans, throw them in the trash, and remind you that it has its own agenda and you're just lucky enough to be along for the ride. Whatever it is, all of us are simply striving to gain the courage and strength to get back up off the mat and continue swinging. Because it's clear that life will never stop piling on the changes, big and small, good and bad, because largely that's all life is when you get right down to it. Death, taxes, and a concerted effort to find stillness and consistency amongst a swirling sea of chaos and constant change. From a Blanket Fort recording studio, in my one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking to my sister-in-law, Lysandra Archer, about change.
But if I feel extra beautiful or just extra in general, my mood is immediately elevated. Versus if I show up in there and like I haven't done my hair in a couple days, I'm not wearing any makeup, which is, it's, I wish that that wasn't such a important part about how I see myself on a regular basis, but it just, it's kind of innate for women. I'm sure for men too, but this is a society we were brought up in. First appearances are really important.
No,
even if you never see those people again.
All the professional athletes that I like are always talking about the reason why they get their hair cut on game days. It's like, look good, play good.
Yeah.
Look good, feel good, play good. Like, I got to look fresh. I got to have fresh fade going on so I can hit my fade away, you know?
So they've shown that women, like women in, that have cancer, you know, lost their hair and probably lost their drive in general just to invest in themselves. If like as a hairstylist before I, you know, before I retired, we would go and we would do days with them where we'd do their hair and their makeup. We'd style their wigs for them. And it has been shown that it helps these people fight their cancer because it's just that little bit of extra that makes them feel valuable, makes them feel lovely, makes them feel desired even in a certain way.
Yeah.
Just that it's that natural pick me up that we all need sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone needs that.
Oh yeah. It's an important part of life.
People go to like retirement homes and do that, you know, like we'll dress you up, do your hair.
Yeah.
You know, everyone needs that.
And I don't think it's vanity. I don't think it has anything to do with vanity.
It's not. It's self-care. You know?
Self-care is so important. It's something like I have learned the hard way.
I'm learning right now the difference between self-love and vanity, because I used to think the two are the same thing, and I used to conflate them all the time. That I was like, everyone that was preaching, oh, you got to love yourself, and you got to find, you really, how are you going to love anyone else if you don't love yourself? I was like, maybe some of you need to love yourself a little less and chill out with how much you're obsessed with, you know. Like that was me being jaded because I didn't like myself and realizing the health benefits of taking time to appreciate yourself and appreciate the positive things about yourself. It's a very, it is different from.
It is. You know. We're not taught that. And then this is like a, you know, topic for another day, but I think that has a lot to do with our society's take on it in religion. So, you know, I remember being raised thinking that being selfish was the worst thing you could possibly do. And people visualize selfishness as this, as taking, as prioritizing yourself over other people, when really that prioritization is actually something that helps you be a better parent and a better spouse and more available to people to be helpful. Because if you're not filling your love bank up and you're not taking care of the crazy that's happening inside of here, no one else is going to. But I was always taught that that was kind of selfish in the bad
way. Yeah, there's a lot of fear of being too focused on yourself. You don't want to be self-centered, and you don't want to be selfish, and you don't want to be self-serving. And it's hard to draw the line or delineate between self-care and self-love and like truly being negatively narcissistic, you know. But I think that there is definitely a distinction, and it's hard because I think we conflate those in our head. Part of it is how we're taught, and yeah.
Kind of weird. But yeah, I get it.
Good place to start.
I know.
Cool.
This is not what we're talking about today. Well, I know. You know, self-care actually has a lot to do with my portion of this podcast. So
definitely.
Maybe it's like related.
I'm sure it helps with dealing with changes in plans. Like having I would call it a program, or like having whatever it is, a plan, a system that you go to when life throws you curveballs, having things that you go to. Yeah, first of all, welcome here. You're here in LA. You're visiting.
My second time being in your apartment.
You're getting a very different look at the fort than most people get, because we just redid our living room. We're really rich now, and we have a 50-inch screen TV. We're very rich. I sent a photo of this to Chris, and I said, I'm very rich now. I hope it doesn't mean we can't be friends. And he said, yeah, this changes everything. I don't know. I don't know what to do about the fort now, but he's doing such a good job of mixing the show that I'm like, maybe I don't need the fort. The fort was kind of used for like sound, but I'm still using this to block the sound of the refrigerator.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah.
I was kind of wondering, I'm like, why don't we just have a divider?
I know. This thing's very loud. The refrigerator puts off this very loud, annoying hum, and you can hear it. And I try to at least put something in the way to cut it off. usually the fort is like in that corner, and we're really, it really makes the room smaller because we have these huge ceilings. Again, we're very rich, very tall ceilings.
Yeah, I actually would imagine that would be tricky.
Yeah, its sound goes up, but yeah, Chris has been doing such a good job that I'm like, maybe I don't even need to worry about it, and I'll just, but I still like it because I got to have the fort. Today we've got an audience behind us.
I mean, I don't think they're listening to a thing we're saying.
They're working, but yeah, Mary's back there working on her, I guess she's reading now. And your husband, my brother, Adam's also reading back there.
He is so into this book.
Just so everyone knows, that's the set, that's the scene. We're in the living room.
It's really chill.
With a new TV.
Laid back.
That Mary's parents bought for us because we're not actually rich. And
some pretty paintings and guitars.
Different kind of fort set up today with my sister-in-law, Lisa.
Hello.
Yeah, let's start at the very beginning of your story. You've had, I think lots of people, I don't think it's unique to have a story with lots of twists and turns and a story with lots of unexpected events. But you seem to have, this seems to kind of be like a big theme in your life, you know, like here's the plan. Here's left turn. Here's what actually happens. So where in your mind does that, what is a good place to start with that?
Well, probably from the very beginning. And it's funny because I never really saw my life as being, a constant state of change. I knew that I have been thrown a lot of curveballs in my life, but I don't think it really clicked in my head how truly consistent it has been. It's almost been the most consistent thing that I have had in my life is the constant change. And so when you started talking to me about it, I really did start to think about that, and it kind of hit me like a ton of bricks. Mm-hmm. Whoa, okay. Yeah. I've never done anything conventionally. And that necessarily isn't a choice that I've made. I think that's just how I was built, or maybe the life I was put into. But I mean, from day one, I was adopted. Mm-hmm. So I was brand new when my parents adopted me. And that right there is a huge shift. And when you're a baby, of course, you don't realize that. Even when you're 15, 20 years old, you don't realize that. But as you get older,
I thought about that till just now, that like, right off the bat, they're like, not this person that you just came out of, but these people are the ones you're going on, like right off the bat. Yeah.
And there is a biological element of that. Mm-hmm. That's very important. I mean, you can hear your mother while you're inside the womb. You can feel her. You know, your DNA is intertwined.
You're prepping to eat that milk.
Yes, like, exactly. Like, you know, Mm-hmm. And there is some drawbacks, you know, when you are taken away from your biological parent. There's a lot of research about that, and it's kind of controversial, but I personally don't think that the love is any different. I just think the biology is different.
Yeah.
So, you know, biologically, you're drawn towards your mother's milk because that's how you are nourished. Mm-hmm. But I actually get it a lot from people that say that adoption isn't a real way of being a parent. And I don't think they understand like how that sits with me, because
it's hard.
Well, and people that are my friends say it, but again, they don't understand that, what that means to me. So if I have a friend who really wants to have a child and that's not an option for them, I will suggest fostering to adopt or adoption, because adoption is the best thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah. Like,
it was a gift for me. And I've had them say, well, I want to have a baby the real way. I totally understand that this is just it's a concept in their mind that maybe they don't have a lot of experience around. It's not intended to be mean.
But there's little twists of language. The real
one. Oh, yeah. One of my favorite was growing up. My mom got this a lot. Oh, God bless you, Sue. I could never love someone else's child the way I love my child.
Ooh. Yeah. Just like,
yeah.
And it's like, meant with probably just the best of intentions.
Well, sometimes. I wonder sometimes. It's like a little dig. I mean, to become a parent in adoption is a very purposeful thing. Mm-hmm. It's not an easy process. It took my parents 10 years to adopt me.
Yeah.
So you have intention when you decide that you are
going to adopt. It took them 10 years to adopt. Was it fostered, well, or were they looking for a child?
They were looking for a child for 10 okay. years. They had one yeah. failed adoption. And then mm-hmm. when I came around, that actually was a fairly fast process. And my parents lived in Bolivia, South America during that time.
Wow.
So they had to
come. How long were they in Bolivia when you, or?
Oh my gosh, I don't remember for sure. I want to say they were there for 7-ish years prior.
Prior
to
that. And they came home.
They came home to get me.
Okay.
So they came up to Goleta, California, mm-hmm. where I was born, and they had to set up residence
there. They're missionaries, right? In Bolivia?
Yep. Yeah. Non-denominational Christian missionaries.
Yeah.
I come from my father, my real father, not my biological, comes from a lineage of missionaries. So it was kind of our family calling. And they had to set residency up in California. So they lived in Santa Barbara. And they were able to adopt me. We had to stay in the States for another 6 months while the adoption was finalized. But then we moved back down to Bolivia. So I spent the first few years of my life in Bolivia, which was, also another.
How long were you in Bolivia?
So I was there until I was 4. So about 2.5-3 years.
Do you remember that at all?
I have a few memories. I remember one time being in one of our houses and my mom was making donuts, powdered donuts. Mm-hmm. And I was a really adventurous child, so I could climb onto anything. Like yeah. you couldn't keep anything away from me. And I remember, so she stopped trying is what I'm trying to say. But mm-hmm. I remember standing on a chair at the counter in my diaper and watching her make these, and I'm just covered in powdered sugar. So I remember that. And then I also remember, we went to the park once, and there are some really gnarly animals down there, especially geese. And I am terrified of geese. And I think this is why. And this very large prehistoric looking goose came after me.
Geese and I'm sorry if your mom's listening to this, but geese are assholes.
They're the worst. I hate them. They poop on everything. They are so mean. They are terrifying. Especially these prehistoric ones. They are no joke.
Yeah.
They have the weirdest things hanging off of their faces.
They're dinosaurs.
They are dinosaurs.
They're mean, aggressive dinosaurs that think that they still have like sharp dinosaur teeth, and they don't, and they need to like
get over themselves.
They need to watch themselves. They need to
I don't want to hurt anybody or anything, but I don't have good feelings towards geese at all. And that's probably why. Yeah, that goose came for me.
Yeah. Okay, so we're growing up, Bolivia. Mm-hmm. You come back, you're back in the United States. Where did you spend your whole childhood in Washington?
Yes, I did. I got really, really sick in Bolivia. I almost died there.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was rough. And then my family had some struggles with the community that they were with. And we just decided, they decided that they needed to bring me home. Mm-hmm. So we moved back to Spokane, Washington, where I spent my entire life up until 19 years old. Mm-hmm. And I would say up until about 15 years old, my life was pretty consistent. My parents were very devoted to me. I was an only child. They spent lots of time and energy on helping me develop as a person. They loved me so much. And I really can't say that I could ask for a better childhood. And we weren't perfect. We made mistakes. But I really mean it when I say being adopted into that family was the best thing that ever happened to me, because they molded me into who I am. Mm-hmm. My parents are extremely integrous people. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. So I would say life was, it was hard because you're a kid, but in teenagers, especially, just hard to be in middle school.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until I was 16 before I experienced my first real, jolt of change that really shifted my direction. Cause I think with every change, this thing happens where we just make a 10% shift in our trajectory in life. Yeah. And
which shirt am I going to wear today?
Yes.
And just
my values and how I view the world. And that was my
little
first
things. Maybe I'm a Democrat. Maybe I actually am a little bit more, it's little things over time that, I know what you mean. Sorry.
No, you're fine. You're fine. Yeah. I think that is very normal, and we don't, not everyone can acknowledge or see that because it's so subtle sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's bigger.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's really subtle.
Yeah.
And my first big change that I can remember was I had a very dear friend who I was convinced I was going to marry. First boy I ever loved. And he died on my birthday, my 16th birthday. He and his grandfather and his two cousins went went fishing off the coast of La Push, mm-hmm. which is in Washington. And they were in a little Boston whaler and it capsized. And
oh, jeez.
They never found the grandfather's body, but they did find James and his two cousins. And that was my first encounter with death head on. And that was my first real heartbreak. And
yeah.
It wasn't, he was a bit older than I am, not a lot, but he was just a really good friend to me. But I was like, oh, I'm going to marry this guy.
You
like,
got a game
sure,
plan.
I'm going to marry him.
You've got a clear game plan for your life.
Game plan.
I'm going to marry this guy. I'm probably going to live in Washington. We're going to have a house in,
have babies.
And in this neighborhood, we're going to take our kids to the same church I was raised in. A clear idea of the path forward. Mm-hmm. And life says, nope. And in the most aggressive way. I mean, that's so intense. That's such an intense thing for
a 16-year-old.
Yeah, for young people to experience. And when you're really close to someone like that too, you really learn, oh, life doesn't care at all about my plan.
No. No, it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And there's levels of that you learn as you progress and grow. But that was my first big one. And sometimes I feel like I don't really deserve to have been hurt as badly as I was by that death, because he wasn't my child. He wasn't even my boyfriend. But it shook me.
I know that feeling of like,
do I deserve this grief?
Do I deserve to be this sad about this thing? And that's a weird kind of guilt or a weird kind of shame to put yourself through. It's mm-hmm. weird. Yeah.
It is. And
you feel what you feel.
Even to this day, like, I'm friends with his parents on Facebook and I watch from afar, but I think of him every birthday, every anniversary of his death. He was a really good person, and there aren't a lot of really good people easily accessible in this world. Mm-hmm. You have to kind of sift through a lot to find them. And that was the beginning of a very big change in my life. I would say it led to some great adventures, but it also led to a lot of really difficult years. And
yeah. How does that change the plan?
Yeah.
So obviously that's off the table now. Mm-hmm. How would you say that, I mean, obviously you have to take the time to come to terms with what's happened mm-hmm. and to grapple with just the reality of it and come to a place of acceptance. But how would you say over the next, I mean, so you're in Washington for three more years. Mm-hmm. How would you say that affects the plan of moving you into what happens next?
Well, I think in a way I stopped having dreams at that point. I was so devastated by that.
Wow.
And there was a series of events that followed it that were probably not as intense, but continued to perpetuate this idea in my head that nothing's really worth it. So I became very, very disoriented or disassociative, I should say, mm-hmm. towards goals and plans.
Kind of nihilistic a little bit.
A little nihilistic, yeah. Mm-hmm. I started drinking very, very heavily. Mm-hmm. I'd partied in college parties. Ultimately, I hate using this word, but I was raped at a college party when it's like a year later. Mm-hmm. Another thing that just tapped
change of plans.
Like just, raised in a Christian home where you save yourself for marriage.
And, I'm so sorry that happened.
But it's not your typical situation. It's one of those where we both made decisions that put us in a specific position, and it was somebody I didn't really know. And I actually don't harbor any ill will towards the guy. I can't imagine it would have been easy to be in his position either.
Mm-hmm.
But again, just another little nail in the coffin of like the sweet, innocent Lisa that was up until that point.
Is no more.
No more. She's dying. She is changing.
Yeah.
I met my birth mom that same year as well. And it was, well, I met my brother, my grandparents, and finally my birth mom. And that was a really cool, positive experience. But I had
How old were you when you met your birth mom?
17.
Okay.
I guess I was 18 when I finally met her. Mm-hmm. But I had this very specific idea of how our relationship would look.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here you think about this person your entire life.
Yeah.
And then you meet them and it wasn't anything like I thought it would be.
Of course.
And and I say this in complete and total, what's the right word? Generosity, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't harbor any ill will towards my birth parents.
Yeah.
I cannot imagine how hard it is to give up a child for adoption.
Yeah.
That has got to be one of the hardest things you ever do.
Yeah.
And so I have never thought ill about my birth mother for that.
Well, and it's important. It's a hard and important lesson to learn, I think, to to not hold people accountable for not living up to our expectations of them, because it's almost impossible when we have, especially when we have a really specific idea mm-hmm. of what our relationship with a person's going to be or what like they're going to bring into our life. Mm-hmm. And it's different from that. Mm-hmm. It's hard. It's a really hard lesson to learn to not hold, blame them or hold them accountable for not knowing the exact thing that you had in your head of how they should feel and how they should respond when you show up, mm-hmm. Or what in that specific instance, but in so many instances, you know. And I think that's, yeah.
You're hitting the nail on the head on that one, because, you know, here's somebody who you have biological tie to mm-hmm. and that you have ultimately this deep love for, mm-hmm. and you feel this fear of rejection.
Yeah.
And then it kind of happens.
Yeah.
It's really easy to guess, second guess your worth in those situations. But I really did have a lot of empathy, and I still do.
Was there a part of you that had hopes of having a mother-daughter relationship, sort of?
Not a mother and daughter relationship, because my mom and I are so close.
Right.
I just never felt like I lacked in that department.
Right.
But I wanted to have a relationship with her. Mm-hmm. And that just doesn't seem super feasible. Mm-hmm. I think it's a self-protection. I don't know why. And that's okay. I'm not going to speculate. But I appreciate her. And I like that I can, if I needed to call her and talk to her, I could.
Yeah.
But she has her own life. And we live in different states. And I would say it was a little hard at first with that. But I know no ill will about it. Mm-hmm. Everyone has their own journey. So,
yeah.
But there was just a series of things that happened within a short amount of time. And I think that created my unhealthy response to change, mm-hmm. which is the fight or flight mechanism. Mm-hmm. And what I always choose to do is fly away.
Yeah.
I choose to run. And that was the beginning of the running. So,
was Utah a running decision?
No, Utah was more purposefully done, but a little bit, yes.
Okay.
It was a running decision. Not as severe as France. I moved to France when I was 20.
Oh, I don't know about France.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so wait, isn't France first?
France is first.
Okay, so what precipitates that?
So I am very similar. We're very artistically uh-huh. bred people. I crave adventure. I crave places I've never seen or been to before. Mm-hmm. I think they call it Fenway is the right word.
I don't know that word.
You should look it up, because it actually purpose very.
I know Fenway Park, like the Red Sox
though.
Play. The Red Sox play in Fenway, or is that the Yankees?
Longing to go to distant.
Who plays in Fenway Park? The Red Sox or the Yankees?
Red Sox.
The Red Sox, confirmed by Adam and
so it's
Mary.
Called Fernway. It's a Fernweh.
Fernway. Yes. Fernway.
And it's just this yearning to be somewhere that you've never been. Or
it's a wanderlust.
It's very much like okay. that. Mm. It's, in some ways, it's almost melancholy.
Mm.
You know?
But not satisfied where you are, always romanticizing other places.
Yes.
I know nothing about that.
Yeah. I'm like, it's literally, I believe that.
Uh-huh.
It's like this, I am.
I know I'd be happy if I lived in Portland.
I need to know what it's like to live among the Eskimos.
Yeah.
I always just wanted to experience everything I could. Life is too short.
Isn't it annoying to know that like we don't get a chance to live in every city?
Oh.
I'm like, who
Heart
knows?
Issue.
Maybe there's just like the dopest stuff in like North Dakota and I'll never go there because I'm like, it's North Dakota. But like, maybe there's like a really cool scene in like one town that I would really mesh with, and I'm not gonna get the chance to find out.
Hey, maybe there's like a group of fire breathers that are just waiting for an Austin Archer to come join
them.
They're
just waiting. And I'm gonna miss out. Like, I've never been to Canada. I think Toronto would be cool. Like, I just yeah. like, and that's like, I don't want to visit these places. I want to live in all of these
yes.
places for at
with
least
the people.
A year.
I want to go live in a hut in Guatemala.
Yeah.
I want to go, uh-huh. I want to go, I don't know. I want to go take backpacking tours and lead mm-hmm. llamas across the Andes. You know, it's just this innate thing. And I think now as an adult, I can look back and see where that longing came from. And again, because of the constant change in my life, I look at these cultures mm-hmm. and I don't have a culture. I am about as washed out of a culture as possible. I was adopted into a family, who had a wonderful family, but we're pretty much, we don't have a deep sense of roots. Mm. And so throw me in there. I have no roots. Mm-hmm. I have no roots. So I see these cultures and I see how beautiful they are. And I want to be a part of that. But you don't just get to move to a place and suddenly become a part of a culture that's been around for 300 years.
I mean, you can. You can just
try,
like,
but they're not going to let you.
Put photos on Instagram of like you wearing like the clothes that they wear at that place and using phraseology. Yeah. People do it plenty. Yeah.
I don't think there's anything wrong with having this sense of wanderlust. I think it's given me a lot of amazing adventures in my life. I mean, moving to France was huge. Mm-hmm. I was in a pretty, he wasn't abusive. It just was a crappy relationship. And I did not know how to end it. And I went and backpacked through Europe like 6 months prior, just totally on a whim. Mm-hmm. Said, I'm going to go to Europe. Bought a plane ticket. I was on the plane 2 weeks. And I just went and traveled.
Did you do the whole thing? Did you like stay in hostels and
oh,
stuff?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I did cool. it. I stayed and slept in train stations.
Oh, man.
I could have been the girl from Taken because I literally have taken rides from complete strangers from airports in Paris.
Or who's that girl? Who are those kids that got accused of murder because they were like Americans living abroad?
The ones in Italy?
Yeah.
Oh, what was her name?
Amanda Knox. Yeah. Thank you, Adam. Amanda Knox, like that story too, where you're just like out living.
Yeah.
And the whole thing was she just didn't behave the right way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And because she's different culture. And also, like, I think that she was in shock. And I think that she just was just not.
She was a kid.
She was a kid.
Like, give her a break.
Yeah. But they're like, she's really acting weird. Let's definitely convict her of this murder.
Uh-huh. Stick her in an Italian jail for a while. Uh-huh. Oh, you know, I did some stupid stuff, but it was fun. I had fun.
You gotta be able to get away with some of that stupid stuff. I mean, it's risky, but like sometimes having those memories,
I wouldn't change it for the world. Uh-huh. Moving to France, I got to live in a little village in the south of France. I was very alone. We were 45 minutes from the nearest big town, and in France, people don't stay in their villages for high school and college. They go to the big city.
They leave in high school.
Yeah, they live in high school. So the village I lived in, I actually lived on the outskirts of it on a farm. Mm-hmm. I'm talking children of the corn, alone, stalks of sunflowers, Pyrenees and mountains behind you. At night, you open up all the shutters and lightning storms so vast that they would shoot across the sky instead of down.
Yeah.
One of the most amazing electrical storms I've ever seen in my life was living there.
Yeah.
And it was fun. I had a really cool family that I worked for, and they really helped me kind of start to create a sense of direction for myself again. But again, when things get really hard, I have to change my scenery because it's just easier to do so than to actually face whatever's been happening.
How long were you there?
I was there like a year, maybe a year and a half over time.
Did you learn the language?
I did. I was fairly fluent when I got back. I just haven't practiced in a long time.
Yeah, you really lose it when you don't use it. Yeah.
I want to take it again, though. It was a great investment of my time. And
I don't think there's any better way to learn a language than immersion.
Especially French. French is a whole other beast.
I took like 5 semesters of Spanish and I couldn't speak Spanish. And then I went on a trip to Mexico once for 2 weeks and By the time I came back, I was speaking better Spanish than I ever had before because it was just about immersion. It was just about like forcing myself to try to speak in full sentences and try to, you know, and I'm sure I sounded horrible and I've completely lost it now. But I just like sometimes understand little things that dishwashers in my restaurant are saying.
I know what you're saying.
Sort of.
Well, I actually made a big faux pas when I first went there. I took French in college and in high school. Didn't learn a drop of it because you just don't that way. I mean, I could say little things, like I could ask for things or express how I was feeling, but I didn't really understand how certain verbs are used or certain just vocabulary, I guess.
Conjugation,
like, et cetera. So we're there. It's first day I'm there and Ellen and Jeff come pick me up and her father's with him and he doesn't speak a lick of English, not a lick of it. And it was extremely hot when I got there. It was July. Mm-hmm. So we're talking, it's probably 102 degrees out. It's hot. And so he asks me, ¿Cómo se va? Which means, how are you doing? Mm-hmm. And I go, ¡Uf! Je suis chaud, which means I'm hot. That's a literal translation.
Yeah.
I am hot. You don't say I am hot in French. You say I have hot. J'ai chaud. I am hot.
Means get it together, France. Well, you don't say I have hot.
Oh, you do. Because when you say I am hot, that means you're horny. So I took my, told my.
How are you doing? Oh, I'm really horny.
Really horny.
I'm just, I'll tell you what. I've never been so horny.
God bless him. He just laughed. He just, oh, okay. First impression.
That's awesome. That's so cool.
So yeah, it was a good experience.
Okay. So what precipitates leaving France? Because you say, once again, got to change the scenario, change the scenery. Do you go straight from France to Utah, or do you go to France to Washington?
France to Washington. What happens when you move away, I'm sure you've experienced this when you move to New York, is you kind of create this feeling that you're missing out on something back home. And you feel a little left out.
It's kind of the same feeling you had before you moved, where you're like, if I don't get to that city, I'm going to miss all the things that are happening there. Yeah. And then you get to that city and you're like, oh, but all my friends are doing stuff back in my hometown and I'm not there. I'm missing all the birthday parties and all the, oh my God.
I was only 21. So it was my first time moving away from home. Yeah. I live in like an apartment and I missed my family, and people would be like, oh, you just need to come home, blah, blah, blah. Also, it's hard to be in a place and not have a specific destination that you're in. You know, the older you get, the more it's nice to have something that you're working towards. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, I'm going to go back. I'm going to try and get my degree and figure out how to come back more permanently. I actually regret that. I wish I had stayed. My life would look a lot differently. Well, I mean, I like how my life is now. But up until this point, that was probably my biggest regret, is not staying. So I decided to move back. And of course, you get back and everyone else has moved on in their life. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of the odd one out. They haven't had the same experience as you. So they can't relate to anything you want to talk about or how you see the world now. So
it was weird how much a place can change in a year.
Oh, it's insane.
New restaurants go up and new people are hanging out at the bar you used to hang out at. And
It was a very weird change. And Spokane is a small, big town.
Yeah.
So you know everybody, but you don't. Everyone knows who you are, but they don't know you well.
Yeah, you see each other around.
Yeah.
Like, I know who you are. I've seen you. Mm-hmm. We nod at each other sometimes.
You know the what's that, 7 degrees of separation or whatever, that type of thing.
You're so-and-so's friend, and I know you through,
I did make some new friends when I came back. I did end up back into a relationship fairly quickly after getting back from France, because I was kind of working on this idea that if I got married and started a family, like everything would feel stable and good again. Mm. Not knowing that actually stable and good was something that really scared me. Mm-hmm. And of course, I jumped into a relationship with a guy I didn't even know at all. He had 2 children.
That's interesting. Uh-huh. You dated a guy with 2 children.
I know. And at this point, I still thought I wanted kids, which is weird because he had a vasectomy. But
there is a pattern.
Mm-hmm. You know what's funny about that? Because the relationship lasted way too long. Mm-hmm. We did get engaged.
How long were you together?
I was 22. So 3 years.
That's long for dating a person with kids. Mm-hmm. It's a long time to date.
Oh, yeah. And those kids were great. Mm-hmm. Actually, his ex-wife and I were so close.
Wow.
And we still are to this day. Oh. I mean, we don't see each other very often, but when I was home over the summer, we had like a 5-hour breakfast, and we still mourn the loss of each other.
Yeah.
Like, I wish so desperately that I was co-parenting with her still, because she is just a gem of a human being.
Yeah.
And those kids are all grown up. They're so big now, and I don't get to see them. I have to watch from afar. And of course I still love them.
Yeah.
But, really glad I didn't marry this guy. He actually called off our wedding a month before the wedding.
Wow.
So let's talk about another big
God.
Change of plans.
I had no, this is like, I'm loving that we're doing this because I only know the things I know. And I love hearing how it's like, here's the roadmap. The roadmap is clear. Okay. I'm back home. I'm going to marry this guy with 2 kids. We're, you know, like, we'll do what we got to do. We'll get his tubes untied or we'll adopt. You know, I'm sure you wouldn't have any problem. I'm starting. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. He throws you the curveball a month before the wedding. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Oh, he did it really rough too. It was, I'm not sure I was ever in love with you. I'm not sure I've ever been attracted to you. And I gained quite a bit of weight in my early 20s because I had a thyroid issue that was not diagnosed.
Yeah.
So at my heaviest, I weighed 220 pounds. Mm-hmm. And I lost quite a bit when I moved to France, because how do you not lose weight when you live in France? It's just the healthiest place ever. Yeah. Well, it really, you eat vegetables mostly there.
Yeah, I think all I think is wine and cheese. That's all.
You do eat a lot of that too. It's pretty good.
And baguettes.
I think I lost 40 pounds while I was there. It was pretty impressive. Wow. Yeah.
All right.
And I started running and whatnot. But so he, that was the story. Like, I'm not sure I love you. I'm not sure that I ever loved you or was attracted to you. And he just
crushes your heart.
Just crushed me.
Yeah. Makes you never want to do it again.
Oh, it destroyed me. Mm-hmm. But I was an idiot and I did do it again. Because I ran. So when that happened, you know, it had been a few years since I left France, but my family and friends said, hey, you can come stay with us for a little bit while you get through this. So I did. I went back to France and spent 4 more months there.
Oh.
In the meantime.
It's a nice place to recover. Nice way to.
I loved it.
Yeah.
Great. Heartache.
And, nice way to do a little detox on. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was safe and it was good there. And, but of course he regretted his decision and started pursuing me again. So when I got back, I did end up in a relationship with him again.
Oh my God.
I'm a glutton for punishment.
I'm loving hearing this story.
I'm not extremely proud of it because at this point in my life, I really didn't value myself as a human being. I really didn't see myself as worthy of love.
Yeah.
And that's a whole different can of worms that I suspect roots back to my adoption,
mm-hmm.
like a very subconscious message.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember saying to people, if he can love me like this, then that shows he's integrous because look at me. Like, look at me. And of course, that was a total lie. And so the next year he broke up with me on my birthday, 2 hours before my birthday party. And he refused to move out of the house we lived in.
You've had some bad birthdays.
I've had some really bad birthdays.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a series of them for sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, now looking back, I hated him for a long time, and I actually am very grateful to him that he did end it because I don't know that I was brave enough to at that point in my life. But once he ended it and we were able to separate from each other, he did keep trying to come back, and I was finally able to say, dude, I can't ever do this again. And I lost a bunch of weight, which of course made him want me more. Mm-hmm. And that is when I decided to go back to school. So at this point, I already had become an esthetician. I'd been working in salons, just doing facials and whatnot. But I really knew I had a knack for hair. I knew I had the skill sets and the artistic abilities. So I decided to throw myself into school. And I slayed at school.
Yeah.
It was so easy for me. And
fish to water.
What's that?
Like a fish to water.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was the captain of the advanced team before. Like, so there's stages you go into. There's like the beginner stage, there's a secondary stage. And then somewhere in here, you're allowed to apply for the advanced academy. Mm-hmm. I went straight into the advanced academy and then I became the leader of the advanced academy within like a month. So it was, it felt really good to be good at something. And it felt like I was moving towards something.
Yeah.
But at this point in my life, I knew Spokane just wasn't for me.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of relationships that I just needed to remove myself from, a lot of mentalities that I had been drowning in. And it was hard. My family's all there.
Yeah.
My entire family's there.
Yeah.
But I decided to follow my dreams and go to work for a company that I knew produced very talented stylists. And I also knew that they were known for being no nonsense, no drama type of salon. And that was Lunatic Fringe.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. So wow. I came to visit Salt Lake City. Let me see. It was December 2014, I want to say.
I'm going to say this. I've lived in
13.
New York and LA and now in Salt Lake. My best haircuts are always at shops in Salt Lake.
Mm.
And some of the best stylists I know and some of the best barbers I've ever met. No offense. I had a really cool barber in Bushwick who I really liked, but he always kind of wanted to force me to do my hair in ways that I didn't want to do. He didn't like the way that I cut my hair, so he would always try to convince me to do other things. But like, he did it. I liked him. He was a cool guy. But yeah, Salt Lake's got like some top notch. Yeah. Barbers and stylists, and yeah,
we're voted the most beautiful city in I think in the world.
What?
Yeah, we are.
That explains why I'm so sexy.
Makes sense to me. You were born and raised in it. I'm just a visitor.
No, you're the one helping everyone in Salt Lake.
I was
look so sexy. Well, yeah, I mean, you still do it every once in a while, don't you?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah,
But it's primarily not what I do anymore.
We'll get there.
But I guess it's because we have the most plastic surgeons, like per capita, I guess. What do you call it, say that? We have more plastic surgeons in Salt Lake City than anywhere else.
Oh, well.
The most talented ones.
I guess it would have to be per capita, because I've got to imagine that Los Angeles County has more plastic surgery centers than anywhere else in the world. But per capita, I could see that Salt Lake probably. Yeah.
They're known for just, well, you know the atypical look in Utah.
Yeah.
It's very specific.
Uh-huh.
And it's very Instagrammable.
Very cookie cutter.
Yeah, I don't want to be that person, but it is. And I'm falling right into it.
But, you still got the little side shave.
I do. I'm trying to keep the little.
You still got the flare. You still got the little dimple ring in the side shave. You know.
Yeah. I definitely try to keep it a little bit risky. Yeah. But so I moved to Salt Lake on a whim. Not really on a whim. I mean, I was planning on it, but again, it was just something new. It was something exciting. It was something I could do. I went to work for Lunatic Fringe, and that was supposed to be the beginning of the career of my life. And I really loved working there. I would have never have left if the things had happened that have happened. But sadly, I started to became really ill in, I think, the second year of doing hair.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in so much pain and I was so sick.
Didn't know why yet, right?
Didn't know why yet.
Yeah.
And I couldn't do it anymore. When you would do hair, you're on your feet for 10 to 15 hours a day.
Yeah.
Good luck going to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Let alone eating.
Uh-huh.
It's extremely hard on your body.
Yeah.
And
one of those jobs where, stepping off the floor for 45 seconds for a pee break is
detrimental to your schedule.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Because you're always running behind anyway.
Yeah. That's how I feel at my job. It's like, I can't step off the floor.
No.
And
People waiting on you.
Yeah.
Well, and the culture was never say no. The culture is you always are willing. So you're not just doing your job. You're also helping.
You're helping everyone else.
And you're keeping the salon looking nice and.
Very similar tips and all that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yep. You know, it's a well-oiled machine.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved working there. It was just a dish. Now that I look at it, it just was a totally different version of myself compared to who I am now.
Even from when I met you, mm-hmm. I feel very different. I mean, you had blue hair and it was like up in like a mohawk, like comb over. It was like,
there was a mullet in there somewhere.
You were like rocking out. You were, I mean, like it was, you know, like it was a very different vibe.
Yeah. I've been subdued a lot.
I still think you retain a lot of your fire and a lot of your.
I don't know. I hope so. I would like to find that fire again.
Yeah.
I don't know. Did I skip around too much? Am I missing something?
I don't think so. So, again, we get to Utah. We've got a game plan.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the game plan takes you there. All right, here we go. I'm going to work for this company that I really believe in and that I really, you know. And once again, life goes, but you can't really do that if I hit you with this. And now mysterious illness is upon us.
Yeah.
And
chronic illness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a beast. It's a very misunderstood epidemic, I feel like, in our country. And
it's also a hard one. The one that you have I guess we can just say it. It's not like holding at Lyme disease.
Lyme disease
is very hard to diagnose get diagnosed for a lot of people. And I think a lot of people have the experience that you had of spending years going, what in the hell?
Oh my gosh, it was hell.
Yeah.
Austin, I spent years being tossed from one specialist to another.
Mm-hmm.
And every single one of them said the exact same thing. We don't know what's wrong with you. Here's a referral to someone else. We should probably get you on antidepressants.
Isn't it something that they commonly go to now if there's some kind of like hard to diagnose chronic pain happening? Isn't it something that they, and it's like marked by fatigue and pain. Like, isn't it something that they go to for like, hey, let's get your blood work done and let's see if.
Unfortunately, no.
That's so
bizarre. Not in conventional medicine, especially not in Utah. And this is where I'll get on my soapbox and good luck getting me off of it. But our medical system is not set up in a way that you can have one practitioner who is really, truly caring for all of your needs. So symptoms are like tree branches, right?
You mean the American medical system has problems?
No, never.
Is that what you're saying? I think I'm gonna have to cut this out of the podcast, because if you're gonna talk shit on the Stars and Stripes right now, you can walk right out of my apartment, because we got the most perfect. Oh my god, yeah, it's the worst. it's awful. It's really, it's really disappointing and it's awful. Broken.
And it's a lot of that's because of privatized insurance companies, right? Because they wanna try and control what's being treated and how.
Almighty
it's being treated.
Dollar, you know, you just can't really compete with. And then the mindset of like, well, it's not, it works. Like, it works for them, for the people who are, it's like, I don't know. Yeah. My paycheck every year says it works just fine, you know? But yeah, it is wild, the runaround that you have to do to get a diagnosis that should be just on a checklist of like, well, let's check for this. And so often, even with my medical plan, it's like, if I have a problem, like I blew my back out the other day, I'm like, I have the hardest time deciding to go see a doctor, because I'm like, most of the time when I go in, they're just kind of like, oh, you're fine.
Oh, yeah.
They don't do anything. They hit my knee with the little reflex thing. They do the bare minimum to qualify for a visit. And they tell me like, here, take some ibuprofen.
Is that a minor emergency you're talking about?
Yeah, it's kind of a thing where I'm like, I can't walk. My back's blown out. I'm really scared. I might need surgery. I need you to take a look at this. And they're like, oh, well, that's not really what I do.
Is that the urgent care or your...
I went to my primary physician. Oh, yeah. But it's still this thing of like, it's just kind of like, well, let's do the bare minimum of like what... And this guy, my guy's really nice and he's a sweet, you know, old Israeli man who's really funny. But it's also like, there's only so much he can do, you know? But it just is so frustrating that I'm like, we don't have the ability to go, I've got an issue with this, and go straight to the person who deals with that. Mm-hmm. And they go, cool, here's the checklist of things I go down. It's always the next person and the next person and the next person and the next person. And that can be a very expensive and very time consuming process.
And exhausting, emotionally tolling. Like, when you're told you're crazy enough times, you really start to believe it.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in pain all of the time.
Yeah.
A lot of people look at you like, you're making this up, right? And they believe the doctors when they say, you should go see a psychiatrist and work through this. Little do they know that I'm like therapy and counseling is like a hobby for me. I spend a lot of time working with counselors and spending time being introspective. I'm very aware of what's going on in here because I have had a lot of trauma in my life. I have to like know how to process things that are coming at me. And when you're sick and you're tired and you're getting boils on your skin from like being touched by color or like hair color.
Yeah.
When your kidneys are going to the hospital multiple times for kidney infections, you get endometriosis and all these other really painful, issues down on your pelvic floor as a woman, all of these things just start going to crap in a handbasket and you go, I can't be making this happen. How am I making this happen? And that's what they want you to believe.
Well, and I've never bought the dismissal of someone's chronic pain as it's all in your head. Cause I'm like, okay, cool. Let's go with what you just said. Even if it is all in my head, mm-hmm. help me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because even if my brain is creating it, it's happening. Mm-hmm. I feel this way. Yeah. So it's like with anxiety attacks. I'm like, even if it is a process that is starting by my brain flicking switches that it's not supposed to flick.
How do we unflick those
how
switches?
How do I get my brain to stop flicking those switches? Because it's causing problems in my life and I don't want it to happen. So whether it's a subconscious thing that I am just the whole idea of, I think that it's just in your head. Cool. Well, let's get busy figuring that out.
Yeah.
You know, but as you found out, it wasn't in your head, which it must have been. Was that a relief?
Yeah, it was. It was hard because finding out you have Lyme disease is like finding out. I don't want to say this word, but it's kind of like finding out you have cancer.
It's a really shitty diagnosis because it just really means here's the rest of your life.
Well, so there's different types of Lyme disease. Acute Lyme disease is if you get bit by a tick, you find out that you have the bite, you go get medications, and then it takes care of itself.
Mm-hmm.
Chronic Lyme disease is if you were bit or infected. It's not just ticks that infect anymore. It's almost anything that can bite can carry Lyme disease now.
Mm-hmm.
It is the number one vector-borne epidemic of our time.
Yeah.
And so if you have chronic Lyme disease, it reboots itself, it reproduces, it replenishes every 6 weeks, and it just creates more and more and more and more. And the spirochete, which is the little corkscrew bacteria of Lyme disease, it embeds itself in dark, damp places. It embeds itself in organs. And you don't just get Lyme disease, because Lyme disease comes with a little gang. So mm-hmm. you get something called co-infections as well. So you get all of these different...
Oh, fun!
Yeah, you get all these different things that you have to treat it differently. They're not the same bacteria. That's why it makes it so tricky, because all of those co-infections like to mimic autoimmune diseases.
Yeah.
And so a lot of...
And then it gets hard to diagnose, because then you've got all these things that look like something else.
Yeah.
And that's the craziest thing about Lyme disease, is that, like, just like you said, as far... And that's been my cursory understanding of it, is that it just sort of, like, creates a slew of problems that makes it really hard to pinpoint what the source is. And that, I mean,
it's insidious.
Yeah.
It is a truly insidious disease. And I remember thinking, I might die in the next few years if I don't figure out what's going on. Mm-hmm. And I'm very fortunate that I had some people in my life who had already been through the same process, and in a very loving and kind way, nudged me towards someone who could help me.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until after I had lost my career. It wasn't until after I felt extremely alienated. I was in a new relationship, and I don't blame my husband for feeling this way, but that was probably scary to watch me deteriorate that quickly and go, are you crazy? Like, you feel really alone. I mean, every time someone would say to me, you're always so sick. I'd be like, yeah, I am always so sick. Thanks for pointing that out. Like,
I know.
I sure love it.
It's just so crazy.
Like, I just want to stay home from school today. No, like.
Like telling a person who's like a paraplegic, like, you're always in that chair.
Yeah,
I know.
Like, weird,
oh
right?
My God. You're right. I am always in this chair.
It's an insensitivity thing, but at the same time, again, no one feels any different.
Like, right.
If, you know, now being where I'm at, if someone tells me that they are constantly sick, my mind immediately goes into, we have something to diagnose here.
There's
a root cause.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I lost my ability to do hair because of this disease. And I got in an accident in Mexico the year before I was diagnosed, or 2 years before I was diagnosed. So it was like almost a year after I met Adam.
So we skipped over that too. So you're doing hair.
Okay, so I'm doing hair.
And then you meet this guy that's a thing.
That's a thing. Okay. Yeah. So before I started getting really sick, I met Adam, your brother.
Yeah.
And Adam has-
And he doesn't have two kids.
He has four.
He's got four.
He's got four children. Okay. Oh my gosh, the first date, I remember being like, dang, he's so cute. It's too bad he has four kids.
He's so cute. I love his adult braces.
No, that was the thing too. He had adult braces.
He had adult braces.
I thought he was so cute though with them. He was so cute.
Smiling.
I don't have a single picture of him smiling from those days. Not a single one.
He would do a little closed mouth smile. But you know, like when a person with adult braces does a closed mouth smile and you can see the braces under their lips and you're like, I see them. Either you're chewing tobacco or you've got...
Oh, I see. And I thought he was so cute with them. When he got them off, it kind of tripped me out.
You were like, can you get them back on?
Well, she had just beard too the same day. So I was like, they do a change for one day. I was like, who are you?
Yeah.
He kept trying to kiss me and I was like, I don't know who you are. So I met him. I was still doing pretty well in my career at this point. And then the stuff just started happening and everything started falling apart. Broke my foot in Mexico while there for a job.
I remember that.
And I tore a tendon in my ankle.
Uh-huh.
And that was like the nail on the coffin for my hair career, because I couldn't work for 4 months. So I lost like over 70% of my clients.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been like a major loss for me, because I loved doing what I did.
Very good at it.
I was very good at it. Mm-hmm. It was natural to me. And I've made peace with it since, because I'm ready for my life to be different and change. But this period of time was probably the most pivotal in terms of, trying to retrain my brain to stop running away from my problems.
Mm-hmm.
And, I didn't have a choice. I didn't have anywhere to go. There was a lot of pressure on both Adam and I to figure this out and to make it work. And it was hard on our relationship. And I felt very lost. And in some ways, I still feel very lost. It's just a little different now. I have more grace for myself than I did back then. But I mean, I have had to mourn that loss very deeply.
Yeah.
And it sucks. You feel like you're not a real adult, right? You feel like you're stunted. Something's wrong with you.
Well, and you know, some people are very lucky to get to live the same, you know, they pick a career that they feel passionate about and they get to do that for their entire life. And that is a gift and a blessing. And some people have to start over several times. And it's hard, especially when you found something that you're like, no, but if that's not what I'm going to do, it's hard.
It's a loss of a relationship. It is a
completely redefining yourself. And,
Well, especially your persona, right? Like when you're a hairstylist, you live one way, you look a certain way, you act a certain way. You are constantly selling yourself. you're always educating yourself. And that's a really fun aspect of that career field.
Yeah.
But you don't make a lot of money unless you are double, triple booking yourself. It's really hard to make it worth it.
Yeah.
So, and I just couldn't do that. I couldn't do it. I could barely stand on my feet for 5 hours.
Yeah.
So this was like, I mean, I look back to this time in my life as probably one of the darker times in my life. And I have great admiration for my husband for sticking through it with me, because I know that was really hard and very scary, especially coming out of a very hard and painful divorce.
Yeah.
And I couldn't have done it without my network in Salt Lake. I have some amazing friends who are incredibly supportive and loving, but I really did have to take a step back and go, I can't just run away from this. I don't want to run away from him. I don't want to run away from this life that I've started to build for myself. And so I had to stand up and look at everything straight on. And I haven't figured it out. I'm still figuring it out. But I did learn how important it was to prioritize myself and love myself, even though I don't have a checklist of things that I'm accomplishing on a regular basis, which is hard.
In the midst of all this, though, I mean, the reason why I was like, well, that's a big thing, meeting that guy, because in the midst of all this, of losing the career and breaking your foot and the diagnosis, like, you're also taking on the task of being a stepmom to these four kids, too. And that's another huge thing where I think a lot of people would go, I can't. There's no way. I just can't. I can't be what these kids need right now. I can't do it. And understandably so. Understandably have that feeling of like, I've got way too much on my plate, just me, to show up for a partner and then to show up for these four kids of differing ages. Like, you know, one who's now an adult. And I mean, it's just like, it's a lot that you were in the middle of. And I'm sure a lot of joy too. A lot of things that were probably very good surprises and good changes. But yeah, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like that, I think that kind of puts you in a place where you almost have to go, I don't think running is an option right now.
No, I wasn't. Uh-huh. I wasn't going to do that to them. I didn't want to do that to them.
Mm-hmm.
My kids are one of the biggest blessings of my life. And they're not biologically mine. I know that. Mm-hmm. And this situation is hard. This is a hard, hard situation. But I love them with all of my heart. So, and I'm naturally codependent. It's something that I am deeply afflicted by. And so it's very easy for me to give too much and just give till I'm completely depleted. And it wasn't until I met Adam that I was able to realize that he wasn't asking me to give him more than I had.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a huge growth step for me so that I could take care of myself and survive all of these changes that keep coming over and over and over again. Like, I've just had nothing sustained in my life up until this point. I've had nothing that's constant. And so, yeah, I guess it really has kind of left me with some whiplash. And seeing these children coming out of this painful divorce, desperate to feel like something was stable and good and safe, I have felt very compelled to throw myself into that to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it's going extremely well with the children. Like, we all love each other greatly. And
you're a real Julia Roberts in this situation. You know, from Stepmom. Oh my
gosh. This is funny. That was one of my favorite movies growing up.
Uh-huh.
And I became a stepmom. Like, what the heck?
You're a cool, and good confidant. You know, they, I think that they trust you and that they, yeah, like, they really, you know.
We have a good relationship.
Yeah.
I will say, though, that this isn't for the faint of heart. And if you're, it makes you question your value very deeply because mm-hmm. you feel like an intruder in a family.
Yeah.
Because you're the new person.
Yeah.
And then you're desperately trying to create something that's somewhat familiar to them.
Mm-hmm.
But that includes you.
Yeah.
But you were kind of always the odd man out.
God, that movie's so good. They really nail it.
So good.
They really nail it. Because it's like, that's exactly it. She's like, I don't want to replace your mother.
No.
But also, I want to create a safe environment for you. But also, I need it to be like, this is me. This is who I am. And
like who I am. Be part of who I am.
Yeah.
And it's the most thankless job. They say being a parent is the most thankless job. No. Being a step parent is the most thankless job.
Seriously. Like, all the work and none of the glory. Oh, all the work and
none of it. And people will never love you the way that they love their parents.
Of course.
And you have to be okay with that.
Yeah.
You might love them more than anything else on this planet, and that love will never be reciprocated in the same way.
Yeah.
And that's a very,
that's a good distinction too, in the same way.
Yeah.
Where it's like, it's not that it's unreciprocated love, and it's not that it's unrequited. It's not that they don't like you. Mm-hmm. It's just that there are ties that can't be replicated,
mm-hmm.
that can't be, you know, but it's kind of like you meeting your birth mother in a way where it's like, the expectation of like, I'm going to have this kind of relationship with her. And it's like the relationship that you formed with your mother,
mm-hmm.
Sue, is you can't replicate that. You can't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yeah. And it's not, I mean, obviously you're going to be more a fixture in their lives than maybe your birth mother is in your life. Mm-hmm. But it's that same maybe idea of like, there's an expectation and it can't be met because probably from them and from you. And I think you both have to sort of come to terms with like what the relationship is, mm-hmm. and what it isn't. And
that's requires a lot of boundaries,
mm-hmm.
a lot of boundaries, because it's very easy for me to get wrapped up when they're struggling and they're in pain and they're hurting from their other home.
Yeah.
And I want to fix it, mm-hmm. and I can't do that. Mm-hmm. I cannot control what's going on over there.
Right.
And all that I can do is try to show them empathy, mm-hmm. and go, well, I can imagine that this is really hard for you. I'm so sorry. But, you know, also you need to remember, you don't know what it's like in your mom's shoes. And maybe she's going through some things that you can't see.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a conversation that I decided that is the conversation I'm going to have, not belittling or bad mouthing. I want it to be, I want them to have healthy relationships with every person in their life, because the more networks that they have available to them, the better they're going to do in life.
Yeah.
And I'm not enough. They need more than just me and Adam. They need more than just their mother and stepfather. They mm-hmm. need everybody.
Yeah.
And there is this loss that you, when you become a step parent, there is this loss of the dream,
mm-hmm.
of having your own family, having all the first being, we're married and let's buy our first house or let's have our first kid together. I don't get any of those.
Yeah.
I'm second to everything. And then the loss of, I'm never going to have a family of my own because we're not having more children. We have four.
Mm-hmm.
We have more than enough.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe we'll adopt down the road. Who knows? It's mm-hmm. possible. But all of these things became a very consistent theme in my life where I had to look at them and go, well, how does this make me feel about myself? How does this, what story am I telling myself? Like, am I less valuable because I'm not biologically going to have children?
Mm-hmm.
I never have a biological chain to somebody in my entire life. Because I haven't, I know my birth father and my birth mother, but my birth father, it's only been for the last 3 years. And my birth mom, I've seen my birth father more than I've seen my birth mother.
It just seems in my mind, like, so poetically fitting, though, that the way you would come into motherhood is like this, you know, that like the way you came into a relationship with your parents was right from the get-go, like we talked about, you know, change of plans, not this person, these people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not adoption, but it's that same sort of idea, mm-hmm. of creating family.
Mm-hmm. You create your own community for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, creating community. Do you want to talk about your most recent big unexpected curveball?
Yeah.
Mostly because it's not, it's not one of those, we saw it coming.
Yeah.
You know, like it had been a while. Like, and we, you know, like it's never easy to lose a loved one, but you know, those times when it's like, we saw it coming down the road. It was just one day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's by far the hardest experience I've ever been through. I mean, it still is. I'm still in it. But so a month after I was diagnosed with Lyme disease and I started treatment, I had plans to go to Spokane for my grandmother's 85th birthday.
Thank God you got to go up there. Yeah.
It's actually very sad because we were trying to get the kids to come up too and things didn't come out. And so we were up there and Adam left, the night before this event happened. But my mother and I were making breakfast and we got a phone call from my dad's work. He worked at a rehabilitation hospital called St. Luke's. Mm-hmm. And my dad was a med tech / do it all, Mr. Fix It kind of guy. And he took a lot of pride in this job. He loved it very much. It was the first job I've ever seen him like in his life. And he had been having pain all week, just in his chest area. But he kept saying, I just pulled a muscle. And we got a phone call from them saying, you need to come down to the hospital. There's been an accident. And I remember every second of that drive. I remember every second thinking, he's going to be fine. He's not going to be dead. He's going to be fine. And they called us while we were on the way down and said, because they were going to transport him to another hospital. They said, are you close? And we said, yes. They go, well, just come to St. Luke's. Don't go to the other hospital. And I said, is my dad conscious? And they said, no, he's not. So, we walked in and it was that terrible scene in a movie that you've seen 100 times, but it was real. You walk in and there's these people standing in the lobby waiting for you. And you could just see it in their eyes. And they say, Mrs. Brunemeyer, can you please come to this other room with us? And they sit us down and there's been an accident and Mark has had a heart attack. And we tried to resuscitate him for 45 minutes, but he's gone. And in that one sentence, just everything changes completely. And then begins the weirdest journey of your life. Like, hands down, the most horrific, painful, confusing, debilitating period ever. And my dad was only 65. He had never had a bad scan or doctor's appointment. He was very healthy. He was very active. And ironically enough, while we were there visiting a few days prior, my dad actually told us that he didn't have long on this earth. And he said, if I should be so lucky, I would have a heart attack at my job and die. And 2 days later, he did. And so,
with everyone in town, thank God.
Well, Adam had left and he had turned back around and come back.
Yeah.
And it won't stop. Like, it won't stop coming at me. Like, I need this to be over. I want some boring years. Like,
it's enormous, the surrealism of a moment like that, because, and I keep saying this, we've talked about this, but that we all know it's a part of the experience of being here, but hearing that sentence spoken out loud to you and then being in that moment that you've seen in movies and TV shows, just like you said, it just feels like, are you kidding me? Like, it feels like, wake me up. Like, I can't possibly be here right now hearing these words, because it just feels like, no, go back in there. Like, sure, no, you made a mistake. You need to go back in there and you need to just like try one more thing, or because that can't be what you're telling me right now. It's so weird how difficult it is to accept at face value.
And it takes a long time. Like, I'm maybe finally to a place where I can acknowledge that it's real, but it's been 9 months.
Yeah.
And shock makes it worse because it prolongs your grief.
Yep.
Shock does horrible things to your body.
It's your body kind of stepping in going, I got to go on autopilot here for a second because we got to make it through the next few hours. And it's like, I understand that mechanism, but what it does is it pushes back the pain and holds it back. And then it gets seeped into your bones and into your muscles and into, and, you know, even if you're grieving out loud, it's still like you're carrying this emotional tension now in your body for,
I don't think it goes away ever. I think you just get accustomed to it. I'm sure parts of it get easier, but it is heavy.
Yeah.
And it's, the pain is beyond anything I've ever experienced before. I think that our brains have a very hard time truly understanding death. And it's this idea that most of us were fully aware is a real thing. Mm-hmm. But until you intimately know death, you have no idea what it means.
Mm-hmm.
And so solidarity is really part of this process, just being around people who have been through it, because they can look at you and go, yeah, no, I know what you're going through.
Yeah.
And you don't have to say anything. They just get it. And yeah. Your brain sees it as a problem that needs to be solved, right?
There must be a solution.
We've got to figure this out. Maybe if we had done this or this or this, we could figure, you know, maybe undo button, redo. Is there an appeal we can throw in somewhere?
Mm-hmm.
But no, they take you down and show you your father laying on a gurney in a room. It's not even a hospital room. It's just a room. And his face is frozen. He's still warm because he's not completely dead. I mean, he's dead, but not for like hours. It's only been like 2 hours.
But the finality
of it. And I mean, seeing him laying there he was just gone. Like he wasn't there, just his body was. But he still smelled the same. And he still felt the same. And it's so hard to know that like your first love, like you're the first person who's supposed to take care of you, is just gone. And you miss them, but then you miss them more and more and more because there's no more making of new memories. All you have are the memories you had. And that stability is gone. It's not there for my mother anymore. It's not there for me. I'm an only child. I wasn't ready to take on the responsibility of being just me and my mom. I'm new to a family. Like I'm trying to figure out how to be a wife and a parent. And it's not just someone dies, it's someone dies and then you lose friends because they don't know how to be around you anymore because they don't know how to deal with the pain you're in. Or he dies and then you have to pack up everything he owns and give it away. And like he had a collection. My father was a collector. And we have this massive collection of history that's sitting in his basement. And I'm going, what do I do with this? This was his life work. I'm not throwing away his life's work or giving it away. And then he dies and your mom's a widow. And she's alone. And she's so sad and so lonely. And she's in another state.
Changes everything.
It changes everything. And now our life will never be the same again.
Mm-hmm.
And it changes you. I'm not the same person I was 9 months ago. I will never be that person again. And that's a tough pill to swallow. But I, you know, it's funny. I never really had the sense that, oh, it's so unfair. I mean, sometimes I'm like, really, this guy's alive? But like our president's alive with how much stress he has? And my dad's someone that's having a talk at times.
Yeah.
Like, and then it just
with
makes
his
you
diet to the president.
Yes. Like my daddy so well, pretty much so healthy.
Yeah.
But no, it's it really messes with your brain. And I am so sorry that every single person has to go through this at some point in their life. But it's scary because now I am acutely aware of how unfair death is. There is no rhyme or reason to how this works. It's just the luck of the draw. If you get another day after today, you are extremely lucky.
Yeah. You know, that old saying, there's two things that are certain in life, death and taxes. Yeah. I think the other one is change. And I think that's been a theme of this whole conversation, is that, like, it's all fleeting and it always changes and everything changes. There's a line in a play by a friend of mine named Ken Jones, who this play's doing great. It's, I think he's had like 30 or something productions, maybe even more, of this play. It's called Alabama Story. And it's about, a library fighting to have a book in its library that's about a black rabbit falling in love with a white rabbit in the 50s in Alabama.
Wow.
And, at the end of the play, these characters are giving kind of their epilogues of what happened afterward. You know, characters step forward and go, so-and-so became blah, 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 blah of this town. And, you know, and this one character who, it's been hinted the whole time that he's maybe gay, but like it never is said out loud. He says something to the effect of like, and I settled down with my best friend, and he like says a man's name, and then he just says, everything changes. And it's so beautiful.
Oh my gosh. And
I think that it's a really good, beautiful way to look at change in our lives, that for better or worse, nothing is permanent and everything changes. Even when you're in a situation that seems hopeless, and a situation that seems so fraught with and so against you, just wait a little while, you know.
That's the truth. I mean,
because life's gonna throw you another curveball, and you're gonna be on to the next thing.
I'm not done. This is gonna be forever. I hope not, maybe in the same rapid consistency, but this is actually something my dad loved that I believed in. He often said that this is something he admired about me, because my parents experienced a lot of loss and change of plans throughout their life as well. Mm-hmm. And I got to a point in my 20s where the pain and the consistency of the pain and the changing was so continuous that it became semi-euphoric to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
I feel as though I am 10 times the person I would have been had I not suffered.
Yeah.
So every time I'm in these situations, my mantra is, I'm really going to like who I am on the other side of this. I'm going to like the person that's
supposed to. I love that.
It's how I get through it.
That's, I love that.
It's always like, this is temporary. It's going to change. And there's, just as much as there's bad change, there's good change too. Mm-hmm. Like I have a life that most people would do anything to have because of the family that I've married into and the family I was adopted into. And so there's so many good things that it's not always a bad curveball. Sometimes it's a better thing that's around the corner. It's just the bad stands out more, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the most growth happens when you're uncomfortable. And I learned that young, and I will stay true to that. This particular instance with my dad passing away, I've been a little more rebellious and been like, well, I don't want that lesson.
Fair enough.
You can take that lesson and shove it. Yep, I don't want it.
Yeah, fair enough.
I don't want it. But, you know, the chronic illness, being in treatment, all of these things, losing my career, having to try and figure out what's next. It's just a challenge that's going to grow me as a person. And I am going to like who I'm on the other side of it, because I will be wiser.
Yep.
I will be kinder. I will be more empathetic and more emotionally available to people who are going through it as well.
Yeah.
Even though right now I'm basically a giant recluse. Just leave me alone.
Which is fine.
So you're just surviving right now.
Of the latest massive curveball. I think we went through almost all of it. Yeah. You feel all right?
Yeah. Thanks for letting me share all that.
I think you did wonderfully.
I hope people are like, this is so dumb. I don't want to hear her life story.
No, it's really great. I enjoyed hearing it because I didn't know half of that. So it's really great. I'm happy that I got you in here and that you wanted to do this.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for sharing all of that with me.
It was my pleasure and very cathartic. So I appreciate that.
I'm happy you're in my family.
Me too.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right. Love you.
Love you.
Mark Brennemeyer was, by all accounts, an absolutely devoted husband and father. Just a real stand-up guy. He was committed to his faith, and, you know, I only met him once at Lisa and Adam's wedding,
And I didn't share many words with him, but one thing I could see, and I think everyone there could see just by the look on his face and the emotion that he showed throughout the night, was that he really deeply loved his little girl, and he was so immensely proud of the woman she grew into. You know, I was at work the other night, and I was coming off a particularly difficult shift, and the shift I was currently on was going a lot smoother, it was going a lot better, and I met this family that I was taking care of, and it was one of their birthdays, and they were talking about how they've got three Aquarians in their family, and I said, I'm an Aquarius, and the mother at the table asked me what my birthday is, and I told her, and then she asked me what my birth year is, and I told her, and she kind of thought about it, and then I walked away, and I think I came back a little later to get them some water or something, and she beckoned me to come over, and she kind of pulled me in close, and she said, hey, has it been a hard year for you this past year? And, you know, it kind of made me stop, and I thought about it, and I thought about, and I said, yeah. And she said, have there been a lot of difficult changes? And I said, you know, I thought about the fact that I just moved to LA a year ago, and the fact that I moved in with my partner, and the fact that I'm, you know, sober now, and that I'm, you know, attempting to live my life in this whole other way, and the fact that my best friend just a little over a month ago took his own life. And I said, yeah. And she said, hang in there. I think things are about to even out for you. Things are going to start leveling out, and it's going to be a little bit more peaceful. And I really felt that, and I feel that right now, that things are really leveling out. And, you know, I don't know what it was that moved her to say that to me in that moment. I don't necessarily know that it's evidence of any clairvoyance on her part. I mean, I think you could take 10 random people and ask them, have you been having a hard time lately? And there's a good chance that all 10 would say, yeah, sure. Or could at least think of something that you might be referencing. And, you know, the wrong person might get quite offended at the question, but on that particular night, she happened to ask the right person, because I was really open and ready to hear what she was trying to say to me, and I was really ready to relearn that valuable lesson that change isn't always such a bad thing. You know, sometimes change is a great teacher and a great opportunity to move into a new space that wasn't previously available. And, you know, it was also a good reminder that if I don't like where I'm at and I don't like the way things are going, all I have to do is continue to put one foot in front of the other and add a little bit of faith in there and just wait around for the next surprise that life has in store. And, you know, good or bad, I'm here for it till the end. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can hear more of my music and more of my projects by going to my website, austin-archer.com, or by looking up Austin Archer on Spotify or Apple Music or wherever you get your music. The show is mixed and mastered by Chris Bjorn at Marmalade Music. You can go to marmalademusicslc.com, tell them that you listen to People Pleaser and get 20% off your first project. Go rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and leave a review. I'll read it on the show and review you back. I think that's all for this week. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week, okay? Love ya. Bye-bye.
Mary, would you be willing to go to the store and give me some throat coat? Thank you.